Hello, and welcome to the Oxford Sidebar podcast for August 2012. It's fair to say that since pre-industrial times, the British diet has changed. The availability of meat, processed foods, and refined carbohydrates like white bread have increased, while the consumption of fruits, vegetables, and fish has probably decreased. It seems likely that our modern lives bear very little reflection of the types of diets that our species evolved on, or even used to survive on up to 200 years ago. In a modern society that, at times, seems obsessed with weight and body image, various dieting schemes, many of which promise much but deliver little, we've become almost fat-phobic. So what is the role of nutrition, particularly fat, in growth, development and behaviour? To help answer this question, we were joined this month by Dr. Alex Richardson of the Department of Social Policy and Intervention at Oxford University. Alex's research focuses on how nutrition can affect behaviour, learning and mood. In particular, she's carried out studies looking at whether omega-3 fatty acids produce improvements in ADHD-type symptoms in children, as well as multidisciplinary research in the biology of development and psychological disorders and the importance of diet for mental health. Without any further ado, I'll hand you over to Alex.
Right, well, there's an awful lot of material that I could cover, but since I usually have the benefit of slides, as I'm sure most speakers bore their audiences with, I'm really just going to be trying to give you an overview of some of the issues that I think really are important and that just don't get enough attention. So the thing I want to start with is the food that we all eat, and quite how it is that we've managed to ignore the fundamental role that nutrition plays in building not just our bodies, but our brains. And the thing that I didn't realise until my research took me in this nutritional direction was quite how much the diet that human beings eat has changed since industrialisation. And it really is a dramatic change. And to expect that our bodies and brains would actually be able to remain healthy on a diet that is quite frankly an uncontrolled experiment is a pretty big assumption. And the other theme that I want to draw out is individual differences. Because when it comes to the issue of food and diet, as I'm sure many of you will know, and it's an old saying, of course, that one man's meat is another man's poison, there are all kinds of individual differences in people's nutritional requirements. And so those two need to be considered whenever we're trying to make any generalizations about diet and health. But let's start with how we've changed our diet. And the thing I'm going to be zeroing in on in particular is the issue of fat in our diet. But I would say that there are two things, and they're really quite simple things, that have changed dramatically, and I mean dramatically, in a period of no more than 150 years at most, but most of the big changes have actually happened in about a 50 to 60 year period, or certainly since the post-war, the Second World War onwards. And really, the one apart from fat, that you're probably all familiar with, sugar. But sugar and refined carbohydrates, by which I mean the white bread rather than whole grain, or white rice, or pasta, you know, these sorts of things. All of these and their effects on bodies and brains are another huge area of concern. But let's just focus on the idea that nutrition is what we have to build bodies and brains from. Because the other thing I'm going to try and weave in, as I cover an awful lot of material, is development across the lifespan. Because there are, of course, critical periods of development, and particularly in very early life, before a child is even born. The diet that mother eats is, quite frankly, going to be the only source of essential nutrients, and by that I mean vitamins, minerals, some of the essential amino acids, the building blocks of protein, but also the essential fats, which should receive far less attention than, let's say, vitamins and minerals. But some types of fat really are as essential as vitamins and minerals. But when a child is in the womb, well, let's just start from the point of conception where two cells fuse, and then in that almost miraculous process of growing a human being from those two fused cells, we are talking a multiplication process of 2 becomes 4, 8, and then the real multiplying away. The most rapid growth that goes on in the womb, all of that is being sustained by the nutrients that mother has either got stored in her own body, in her own tissues, and or that she is imbibing every day through her diet, or not. And quite frankly, one of the issues that research has really been turning up some quite shocking findings is the importance of diet before a child is even born. Because some of the building of body and brain, there are going to be irreversible differences that occur that are, quite frankly, a direct result of the nutritional status of the mother. But then if we move through the lifespan, the diets that children eat in early life, the breastfeeding versus formula feeding debates and the evidence from, breast is always best. But having said that, the nutritional quality of mother's breast milk is again going to reflect her nutritional status. So we've got issues there, and we can't imagine that all breast milk is, I don't know, it isn't identical. And international studies show that. Then as we move through into older childhood, some of the conditions in which nutrition is starting, but only starting to be seen as a potentially important factor, are indeed conditions like dyslexia, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, for those of you who don't know that lovely acronym, but I think everybody does by now, it's become almost the modern day epidemic. Now, ADHD involves a combination, or one or the other, of behavioural problems like impulsivity and hyperactivity, and or attentional and concentration difficulties. But then we have other childhood developmental conditions that again all appear to be on the increase, or are certainly being more commonly diagnosed, or suspected as a diagnosis. I'll come to that word in a minute. Things like the autistic spectrum. And also conditions like dyspraxia, which is about as unknown as dyslexia was, let's say, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Dyspraxia refers to specific difficulties in coordination and movement. But in fact, it's more fundamental than that. Difficulties in the planning and carrying out of almost any complex sequenced actions. And in small children, you'll see in things like learning to tie your shoelaces or buttons, or how good children are at some of the most basic of gym and sports. You know, these are what used to be called the clumsy children, the overtly dyspraxic. All of these conditions are ones which actually affect children's life chances very fundamentally. And their prevalence now, I know this diagnosis is a controversial area, and I would agree with that controversy. These are not diagnoses in any standard medical sense. There is no objective test that you can do to find out whether you are or are not dyslexic or ADHD. They are, in fact, descriptions. That's all that they are. They don't really tell us anything we didn't already know. They're all based on descriptions. The same goes for almost all of the diagnoses used across psychology and psychiatry. And so as we kind of move through the lifespan, although conditions like depression, anxiety, certainly schizophrenia, are extremely uncommonly diagnosed in younger children, as people move through into adolescence and young adulthood, that's actually the prime period for these sorts of conditions to start to emerge, whether they're recognised or not, whether they're properly managed or not. And again, some of my research has involved not just studying the role of nutrition and diet in these childhood conditions like dyslexia, dyspraxia, ADHD, but also the role of diet in mental health. And some of the earliest work that went on, looking at the role of dietary fats in particular in depression and schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, I was fortunate enough to be in the right place at the right time and was involved in some of those studies. Now, I can't hope to cover the wealth of what research has shown of the importance of fats, you know, to the human brain and the human mind, and to our behaviour, learning and mood, in as short a talk as I can give this evening, but I want to give you some of the fundamental key points here. So let's go back to the fats in our diet. And there is so much confusion in this area, and no surprise, because the messages we get tend, of course, to be from the media, for whom a large source of their material and news stories is press releases from companies who want to sell you something. But then even if it's more respectable sources of information that are actually backed by studies, the conflict and the confusion is remarkable. But we have somehow been led to believe, and it's been part of our culture, that fat in the diet is somehow a bad thing, and that fat makes you fat. So we really have had, for a large part of the last, say the post-war period was when it kind of began, but it really took off, I think, in the 60s, 70s and onwards, where people just became pretty much fat phobic. And the linking of dietary fat to obesity, I think, has been one of the biggest sort of mistakes that we've been led into. Because what it's done is it's made people lump all types of fat together. It's made people choose low-fat foods, thinking low-fat means healthy. No, it doesn't. Because if you're going to get a low-fat version of some food that might naturally be high in fat or just moderate amounts of fat, what the manufacturers are usually doing in order to make it palatable at all is adding phenomenal amounts of sugar and all kinds of additives and texture modifiers and things, which, quite frankly, is probably going to be less healthy for most of us than consuming the real thing. But let's go back to the types of fats in our diet. Because broadly, you can divide these into the saturated fats. And these ones, chemically, it means they have got basically no double bonds in the carbon chain that makes up the backbone of all fatty acids, which are the chemical constituents of fat. Saturated fats, you'll know them from their texture and composition at room temperature. Basically, if it's a hard or solid or semi-solid fat, like the fat on meat, or butter, or lard, or let's say coconut fat. Some of the tropical fats have quite a high proportion of saturated rates. They're basically solid or semi-solid at room temperature. Okay, so that's a fairly good guide to how saturated your fats are. But these have tended to be demonized, and quite frankly, rather unfairly. There is absolutely no evidence that I've been able to find that saturated fats are, per se, harmful or unhealthy. It's really a matter of balance. And the foods that are high in saturated fats, if it's going to be, a cream cake, you know, smothered with yet more extra cream and made with butter, and then you drink a full glass of milk with it, etc. It's more likely to be, again, the composition of the food as a whole, and your diet as a whole, that's going to be unhealthy. There is nothing about saturated fats that's unhealthy in and of themselves. If we turn now to unsaturated fats, these ones are actually liquid at room temperature, so oils would be a better name for them than fats. And we divide those into monounsaturates, which have just one double bond in their carbon chain, for those of you who are interested in the chemistry, and polyunsaturates. Polyunsaturated fats have many double bonds in their carbon chains. Now, again, I want to clear up some confusion. Saturated fats are not essential fats. If you needed to, you could synthesize those fats for yourself from other components. Monounsaturates, which have a healthier profile, olive oil, that staple of the Mediterranean-type diet that they keep telling us about, that one, as well as most nuts and seeds, they tend to have quite a proportion of monounsaturates, but again, they're not dietary essentials. We could make those monounsaturated fats for ourselves if we needed to. But it's the polyunsaturates, by which we mean two broad series, groups, families of fats, the omega-3 and the omega-6 fatty acids. These are the primary polyunsaturated fats in the human diet, and these are dietary essentials. So they really are like vitamins or essential minerals. We need these things. We need them for life, we need them for health, but we can't make them. So they have to be in our diets. And it's here that we find the changes that have gone on since industrialization really have been profound and dramatic. Because what we've been doing is changing the balance of omega-3 to omega-6 fats in a direction which is not good for physical health. And according to the latest research, in which, as I say, I'm privileged to be involved, it is absolutely not good for mental health. In fact, the damage that the modern Western-type diet is doing to bodies is all too visible. We look at the epidemics of obesity and diabetes. We look at the problems of heart disease and cancer and other degenerative diseases. And quite frankly, back even as recently as mid-Victorian times, these were remarkably rare. And so I can't emphasize this enough. Heart disease and stroke, these are remarkably recent phenomena in human history to be afflicting huge proportions of our populations. And we tend to treat them these days as, oh well, as everybody gets older, everybody's going to... No, that is not what used to happen. And in fact, one of my colleagues, and somebody who is an extremely popular speaker at our charity, Food and Behaviour Research, Fab Research, holds conferences for general public audiences, as I imagine this one to be, and also for particular groups of professionals. But Paul Clayton teamed up with a historian. He himself has a background in medical pharmacology, but became interested in nutrition very quickly after his summa cum laude degree in medical pharmacology. And he has done an absolutely stunning analysis of the early to mid-Victorians and how they lived, worked, and died, which is actually the title of one of the summary papers, but he's actually got three detailed scholarly papers that he wrote because they had so many findings that were important to outline from this. But in terms of the causes of death, and even in terms of life expectancy, there were some really quite striking findings when they looked at the data from the period about 1840 to 1870. We've all been led to believe that diseases like heart disease, cancer, and then degenerative diseases, including, of course, the dementias in the mental health domain, that these, oh well, as people get older, these are almost inevitable, and we're getting more of these because we're living longer. Well, the first myth that he and his co-author managed to bust was the idea that we're living longer. Well, we're not actually living longer than people did in that period. We are living longer than people did in 1900, but that was a low spot. And quite frankly, the data, and I would encourage anyone, do get in touch with me via Fab Research if you want to know more about this, but the data from that mid-Victorian period, pre-industrialisation, in terms of the physical health of people who lived at that time, the general population, most of whom were, of course, working class, and they took account of that when they were looking at the life expectancy figures too. The data are extraordinary because the causes of death, quite frankly, heart disease, cancer, these were vanishingly rare. And it tended to be accident or infection and things. These were the causes of death. And people were remarkably healthy, both physically and mentally, right up to the days before, or at least the weeks before they died, in the majority of cases. We did not have the degenerative, and of course the burden on the health service, the kind of conditions which are almost assumed to be normal and natural and a consequence of, well, we're all living longer, and as you get older you get these diseases. That's simply not there. But let's think about the diet thing here. I was shocked when I saw that the average calorie intake for just an average working woman in those days was actually about 4,000 calories a day. And for a man, it was around 6,000 calories a day. Now, quite frankly, you would need to be an Olympic athlete in full training to be able to get through that amount of calories these days, and not to become remarkably obese. But of course, obesity was vanishingly rare, apart from in the absolute sort of upper classes who worked not at all, hardly moved from their sofas. And they were the first, of course, to start getting the refined carbohydrates, the white bread rather than that coarse brown rough stuff that contains the fibre that you actually need for your digestion to work properly. And if your digestive system doesn't work properly, therein lie the roots of, quite frankly, all disease and ill health. But that's for another day. The fats in the diet, they ate so much more fresh, whole food, so unprocessed fruits, vegetables, whole grains, etc., that their diet was, in fact, what Paul Clayton and his colleagues called a super Mediterranean diet. We're told these days that 5 portions a day of fruit and vegetable, and at the population level, we don't get near that. In fact, these people were consuming well over 10, 12, or even 15 portions of fruit and vegetables a day, and the nutrients that are there in fruit and veg, vital for health, physical, mental. When it comes to fats, they didn't eat anything like as much meat as we did, and therefore the saturated fats that you will find on the fatty bits of meat and so on were a much smaller proportion of their diet. They also ate more fish than we do these days. and I'm going to dwell on the fish, because this is the theme that I want to lead through to the 20th century, what's gone wrong, and why the diets we're eating today are raising, quite frankly, everybody's risk, whatever your genetic predisposition, they're raising everybody's risk of poor mental health and performance, quite frankly, right across the range. The thing is that the omega-3 essential fats, which are absolutely needed for brain and body, but particularly for the brain, fish and seafood are, quite frankly, the only natural sources that provide appreciable quantities of these essential fats. So people who don't eat fish and seafood, they are relying on a conversion pathway within the body to convert some much simpler omega-3s into the long-chain omega-3s. I'm not going to go into the chemistry here in detail. I'll be happy to talk to people afterwards who want to know. But it's the long-chain omega-3 that we find in fish and seafood that are vital to the brain. And another point I want to drop in, because this usually, again, quite shocks people, that when we look at the way that we've changed the fats in our diet, and also this cultural thing that I spoke of earlier, where people have almost become fat-phobic and think low fat equals healthy and all fat is bad, if you ignore the water content, then in fact 60% of the brain is fat. It is about the most fat-rich organ that we possess, and therefore the fats in your diet are going to be the fats that end up in your brain. And when it comes to the normal structure and function of brain and nerve cells, the omega-3 fatty acids and the omega-6, which are the two main forms of polyunsaturated, they are absolutely essential to the normal structure and function of brain and nerve cells. If we go beyond structure and we look at what the body and brain use these fats for, omega-3 and omega-6 are actually raw materials for a whole super family of regulatory substances that govern just about every physiological and chemical function in the brain and body. And I'm talking here about your hormonal system, which is an absolute orchestra of different substances. I'm talking about your immune system, because the balance of omega-3 and 6 in your diet, and the amounts of each, will absolutely affect the functioning of your immune system. And I'm also talking about blood flow and circulation, and therefore cardiovascular health and our risks of heart disease and stroke. Because the balance of omega-3 and 6 fats in the diet will also determine whether your blood clots easily or doesn't. And in a very, very simple boil-it-down way, I'm going to tell you that the crux of the matter is that the diet that we evolved on, and the one that really they were eating up to the mid-Victorian period, had no more than a ratio of about 4-1 in favour of omega-6. And in much earlier sort of hunter-gatherer type diets, estimates go down as low as equal parts, a ratio of about 1-1. Nowadays, in a modern Western type diet, the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6 has changed dramatically. So what we've got is not enough omega-3, far too much omega-6. They are essential fats, we need them, but we are getting an absolute excess of them. And the ratio these days, anywhere from 15-1, 20-1, or even 100-1 or more, in favour of omega-6. It is a relative deficiency, but a really profound one, in these omega-3 fats that you get from fish and seafood. Now, in terms of the implications of this, mothers whose diets don't include enough of the long-chain omega-3, and whose nutritional status is therefore not optimal, we know from animal studies, and of course it's unethical, and we never will be able to do such studies in human beings, we've just done the uncontrolled experiment and are living with the consequences. But omega-3 deficiency in the womb, in very carefully controlled animal studies, actually does lead to some lifelong changes. It's something they call nutritional programming. And in terms of brain effects, some of these are quite disturbing, because in animals at least, a lack of omega-3 in the maternal diet raises the risk of depression and anxiety in the offspring. And they've even been able to pinpoint some of the mechanisms through which. And one of them is one that involves the endocannabinoids, basically the brain's own cannabis. It was the 1970s that we discovered our own opioids. It was actually only in the 1990s that they discovered, oh my goodness me, we do make our own cannabinoids, there are very few systems that these substances don't influence. In fact, the main, many cannabinoid receptors, but the CB1 receptor is the most prevalent receptor in the human brain. And the main endocannabinoids are made from the omega-6 fats. So I'm going to draw a very simplistic analogy here. I'm going to say that let's suppose that your environment in the womb is awash with long-chain omega-6. That is likely to make you awash in endocannabinoids. And what appears to be going on is that this can actually turn down the settings and almost leave you not sensitive enough to your own cannabinoids throughout the rest of your life, which might indeed leave you a little bit more anxious, more prone to depression, or more sensitive to perceptual stimuli. But for other folk, that's fine. Now, these, as I say, nutritional program effects are really quite worrying. And the fact that we can't do human studies where we tinker around and, you know, do what we do with animal studies leaves it as an open question. We all know that it's very difficult to generalise from animals to humans, but that one worries me. We also do know from epidemiological studies, and the biggest birth cohort study, and the best anywhere in the world in terms of data collected, follow-up of the children, is actually the Children of the 90s study that was carried out in the Bristol area. The Avon Longitudinal Study of Parents and Children, ALSPAC it's known as. And a colleague of mine, one of the leading, not the leading, researcher in the world in omega-3 and psychological and psychiatric disorders, he got his hands on that data set, which included measures of mothers' fish eating during pregnancy. Because I think you'll also be aware that lots of women are worried about the warnings of, oh, careful about the mercury and fish swim in polluted oceans. And so it was already a low intake of long-chain omega-3 during pregnancy has fallen even further. And what these researchers did, they were able to take into account a whole array, hundreds if not thousands, of potentially confounding variables, and to look at the effects of mum's intake of omega-3. I need to be careful with my language here because we can never say things are causal when it's a population epidemiological study, no matter how well controlled. Mum's intake of fish and seafood during pregnancy predicted the intelligence scores of the children at the age of 8. It predicted their social skills and their motor skills. And in every case, the mums who stuck to the official dietary recommendations, not to eat more than 2 portions of fish a week, their children actually had worse outcomes on these developmental measures than the mums who exceeded current dietary guidelines. There was no upper limit of benefit that the researchers could find from fish eating during pregnancy. And that represents, really, it's probably better than a randomised double-blind placebo-controlled trial in terms of the number of variables they were able to take into account, which would be impossible to do in a controlled trial, let alone you couldn't do one for such a long time period. So those data, they've actually led to a revision of dietary guidelines groups in the US, which is, we hope, due to be announced in the next few months, but I have this information from a recent conference, and there has been a dialogue going on with the US dietary authorities. Now, I'm just going to say to you that when it comes to child behaviour and learning difficulties, we need a lot more of the controlled trials before we can be really sure that adding more omega-3 to a child's diet at that stage really will help improve their behaviour or their learning, because they're a mixture of very small studies done in a variety of settings with a variety of groups. But last year, a meta-analysis was carried out by a sceptical Harvard team where you pull together all of the randomised, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials. It involved, overall, about 600 children, not a huge number, but they were able to show, to their own surprise, there was indeed an effect of omega-3 on ADHD-type symptoms. So supplementing the diet with omega-3 in children whose minimum age was about 7, and some of them were into the teenage, but most of them were primary school-aged children, omega-3 fatty acids added to the diet, and I mean the long-chain ones from fish and seafood, did show a benefit. For dyslexia and dyspraxia, we have a few small studies, but in our own study of children with dyspraxia, although they didn't have that label before we went into the schools of County Durham to do the study, we just knew we need a diagnosis if we're going to publish in a journal like Paediatrics. So we were the ones who asked the teachers to find us children who met this profile. We tested them, including a full IQ test to give them that diagnosis. But what we found in that study was not just a reduction in their ADHD-type symptoms, a significant one. They concentrated better, behaved better. We also found a significant improvement in their reading and their spelling performance, such that in 3 months of dietary supplementation, the gain in reading age was actually 9 months in the supplemented children, whereas the placebo group just managed the expected 3 months increase in reading age. And for spelling, it was a 6 month versus 3 months for active treatment versus placebo. We want to see that study replicated. It was published a few years ago now, but in terms of a simple treatment for literacy difficulties, that certainly looks like something that's worth following up. Now, I'm also now going to briefly mention, but again, we need more data, the mental health issues. The conditions for which there is most evidence that the long-chain omega-3, and they're called EPA and DHA, there are two long-chain omega-3 that you need for a healthy brain and nervous system, in depression, and also if you add in those trials of bipolar disorder or manic depression, where the focus was, can we lift the depressive symptoms? There are now more than 30 randomised, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials. There are about 6 or 7 good meta-analyses. And as far back as 2006, the American Psychiatric Association, based on a much smaller meta-analysis of much fewer studies, far fewer studies, they decided that there was sufficient evidence to make a treatment recommendation. And that has actually stood as the American Psychiatric Association's guidelines. There is a treatment recommendation of at least 1 gram a day, 1,000 milligrams of EPA and DHA, in addition to whatever the standard treatment might be that somebody is receiving. This is absolutely not a substitute for standard treatments, and nutritional or dietary approaches are never going to be a substitute for other approaches that might help. But my argument would be that nutrition is a fundamental, and we all eat. We have to eat to live. We all eat every day, and therefore to get more awareness and more education, particularly of the professionals across a range of disciplines, health, education, social sciences, criminal justice, that food and diet can and do affect behaviour, that to me seems a rather important thing to do. And it's the reason that I set up the charity Food and Behaviour Research, or fabresearch.org, if anyone wants to go to its website, with some research colleagues. It's a tragically underfunded little charity. It is kept going by the dedication of the people who contribute to our events, conferences, to the website. I want to pay tribute to Fiona O'Fee here, who will blush. She's down from the Scottish Highlands, but without Fiona O'Fee, Fab Research wouldn't exist. She is its administrator and plays many, many more jobs than that. The thing is, dementia is probably the area where we're going to see far more studies done. And we don't have enough studies yet, and we probably will never be able to really address definitively this one because of the long-term effects that nutrition has on health. And because once dementia has already become established, that might be a bit too late to be expecting that any dietary treatment might actually reverse the degeneration that has already occurred. And in fact, that's exactly what the few trials, properly controlled trials in that area, have shown to date. The first study of Alzheimer's that was published in 2006, they did find that in early stage Alzheimer's patients, when they separated them out as a post hoc group, there was some slight benefit, but there was no benefit in the group as a whole. And again, given the, there have been a few other attempts to find out, could giving omega-3 prevent cognitive decline? But they've suffered from the sorts of problems whereby, oh dear, we got a lot of money and we recruited a lot of people and we did the best we could, but over the period that we could afford to study them, the placebo group didn't deteriorate, and therefore we saw no difference at all between our active treatment and our placebo. Because again, no one would expect a simple nutritional supplement to significantly increase cognitive performance at that age. What might be more plausible, and what the current hope is, that you might be able to prevent or slow down the rate of cognitive decline. But I don't want to go on for any longer because I want to take questions, and there seem to be more of the audience than I might have expected are very focused, it seems, or have perked up visibly at some of the things I've just mentioned. I've done the most superficial skim over an area. I've had no time to go into what you might do to get across the detail of any of it. But what I'd like to do at this point, if that's appropriate, Annie, I don't know the format here, is open up the floor to questions, and I've certainly got plenty more I could tell you, but let's see what it is you want to know. Got some already?
Yes, I mean, I accept your point about a diet probably have radically changed, but mm-hmm. you brought up the issue of you're defining conditions.
Yeah.
To what extent can you take that to account? So, uh-huh. a while ago, you mentioned about depression. I mean, a report came out and said up to 6 million people in Britain suffering depression. That makes me sceptical.
Yeah.
I think, well, how is depression used to be defined as people suffering from, say, serious bipolar disorder? So now you can maybe go to your doctor, fill in a form, and say, have you felt low for a couple of weeks? And you tick the box, and there's another depression statistic. So, what extent?
I completely understand your scepticism. Thank you for raising that one. In fact, I mean, yeah, there is huge controversy over this. There's going to be even more as they roll out the new edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM. Which is kind of the Bible, I suppose, of psychiatric diagnoses and so on. Because they've been broadening things out still further. There's been a lot of controversy over, and I'm not quite sure, I need to read up on what the very latest decision is, but they're trying to include things like bereavement. Yep, that's depression, therefore should be treated with antidepressant drugs like everything else. But let's... I'll give you another statistic before I comment more broadly. There was a paper published just last autumn, and it was a very rigorous multi-author study that did the best it could to come up with prevalence estimates of pretty much every psychological, psychiatric, and neurological disorder, and it concluded that 38% of the European population in any given year is suffering from a diagnosable psychiatric or neurological disorder. Yep, nearly 4 in 10 diagnosable mental health problems. But really, yeah, you've raised a fundamental issue here. What's normal? And that's why I want to come back to something that I just planted at the beginning. Individual differences are the norm. And when you have things that are defined really by descriptional and by self-report or by somebody else's just interpretation or observation of your behaviour, it is very difficult indeed to come up with diagnoses that are any better than the ones they've got, because what they've tended to focus on is it reproducible? You know, would a different rater or with the same box-ticking exercise arrive at the same thing? And as you say, whatever the criteria are that are used to judge this, have these shifted over time? They certainly have. But I think, to be honest, whenever there is this issue of, is autism really, you know, becoming so that it's now 1 in 88 instead of 1 in 10,000, I think you have to accept, when you look at as much of the research as I have, the truth is somewhere in between. I would absolutely say myself, there is a massive tendency to over-label, and some of the pressures for that, of course, are coming from all kinds of organisations that actually stand to benefit from, you know, we can find the treatments, etc. But at the same time, the extent of the increase, and I've singled out, you know, the autistic spectrum for a good reason, you know, that is one where the changes are so dramatic that, yeah, some of it for sure is real.
I have a sort of double question. We have, you know, these kid stories about producing the same fish oils.
Yes, the...
And so I wonder if you could just tell us what you know about that. my daughter's 3 months pregnant, and I'd like to know what I should be telling her to eat without avoiding the gluten. So could you just tell us what supplements you take?
All very good questions. Okay, in case everyone couldn't hear those, because we've got microphones around the room, the question is about the potential, I'm going to add that, pollutants, that might be in fish and seafood, and what somebody should do, particularly if they're 3 months pregnant and they're trying to think, what's the healthy thing to do here? As I say, I'm very struck by this Children of the 90s study. And I can't emphasise this enough, because when they came up with the dietary guidelines, the people who were asked to come up with an amount of fish and seafood which would be safe, in inverted commas, you know, in probabilistic terms, they were only asked to assess the risk side of the equation. Nobody even thought about the fact that fish and seafood were the only natural sources that provide an appreciable quantity. There are other dietary sources that provide trace quantities, but nobody thought about the benefit side of the equation. So what they did was they really treated fish and seafood as though it was nothing other than a vehicle for delivering, or potentially delivering, methyl mercury, PCBs, etc. And it was the mercury they focused on in particular. But the children of the 90s study, this was a birth cohort study where 15,000 women were recruited in early pregnancy and followed through, and their children followed through, and they're still being followed up. So these were real women who ate real fish and seafood, or didn't, and had real babies. So there, particularly because they could control for the hundreds and hundreds of other variables that are known to affect intelligence and social skills and motor skills, this really, to me, that's why I say this is really powerful evidence. And it takes into account the risk-benefit bit. Quite frankly, there was no upper limit of benefit. The more fish and seafood women ate, the better, you know, were the outcomes on those measures from those children. When they were asked by some of the referees of this paper, which was published in The Lancet in 2007, if anybody wants to look it up, fab website, or Hibbelin et al., but the ASVAC study published in The Lancet 2007, when they did actually take into account the mercury in umbilical cord blood, because they had that measured as well, it actually strengthened up the significance of their findings. It is true, there was a slight positive correlation between umbilical cord mercury and fish intake, but the benefits so outweighed the risks. However, having said that, we know how human psychology works. Somebody has said that there might, just might, be some toxic substances. Well, there's a lot more toxins I wish people were worried about than mercury in fish, quite frankly, which is, it's only certain species of fish. There is very good information on the internet about which kinds of fish are the ones that pregnant women should try to avoid. But for the most part, as I say, the risks have been overblown. If I were a woman in early pregnancy thinking, what shall I do? I probably would choose to err on the safe side and go for a clean supplement. That would be my personal choice. As for which supplements do I take? Yeah, I do take omega-3 long-chain supplements. And in fact, I may as well share with you what actually was a spur to doing that if my research findings, which I haven't got onto really yet, weren't. When I was researching dyslexia, which was what took me into research at the physiology department here in the University of Oxford, we were actually studying vision and whether visual and attentional difficulties might contribute to reading difficulties. It was through the link with vision and omega-3 that I got interested in, oh, I wonder if omega-3 might help. Because without these long-chain omega-3, and one of them called DHA in particular, you wouldn't have a visual system. DHA makes up 30 to 50% of your retina. No other fatty acid can substitute for it without a thousandfold drop in efficiency in the transducing of light into a signal. So quite frankly, for vision, omega-3 is critical. So that had led to me thinking, right, maybe we could do some trials on omega-3. But in the meanwhile, having to work at two extra jobs to fund my own DPhil, working in really unergonomic circumstances, I'd come down with the worst case of repetitive strain injuries that the doctors have ever seen. For 2 years, I took the hideous, vile anti-inflammatory drugs. I wore the calipers that stop you bending your wrist, and I was just in agony most of the time, night and day, but you just carry on. When I finally got to see, and it was only through my Oxford colleagues who kindly found for me one of the top specialists in the country, his verdict was really rather sad. He meant it very kindly. He was a very, very nice man, but he just told me, he said, look, you've got to accept, he said, that you're completely crippled and you're never going to use either of your hands properly ever again. Well, that was quite depressing. That's a long time ago, into my DPhil studies. But as it was, you don't have many options. You can't just not use your hands, you battle on. But it was the omega-3 that I'd come across through the link with vision that I was about to start taking anyway, because I don't ask my research subjects, or victims as we call them, to do anything that I haven't already done. So I've crawled into scanners, given pints of blood, I've done all sorts of things in the name of research. But it was therefore I was about to anyway, before asking any of my research subjects to do so, I was about to start taking the omega-3 supplements and see what they might do for me. But in the reading up, I was so struck. It's not just vision. I'm going to come back to what I said about the immune system. Omega-6 fats are broadly pro-inflammatory. There are some details within this, one or two omega-6s that might not be included in this, but they're not common in the diet. Omega-6 fats are the substrate for pro-inflammatory substances. Omega-3 are very powerful, natural anti-inflammatories. And up to that point, it has to be said, I was somebody who thought that I didn't like fish and seafood. I just never ate any. I would always choose meat or dairy or eggs or something else off the menu. Those are very rich sources of the long chain omega-6. So my own balance of omega-6 to 3 would have been about as imbalanced as goodness knows what in those days. It took 2 weeks of high-dose fish oils to throw away the anti-inflammatory drugs. I've been working my way back towards finding ways to not put my arms and wrists under so much stress, work my way back, but the dietary change, I swear in my own case, just made a huge difference. So to this day, I don't touch anti-inflammatory drugs, I still have to kick the crunchy joints slightly sometimes, but I can use my hands and arms, and I take between 1 and 2 grams a day of a long chain omega-3.
Could you actually give a recommendation, because I've been taking it for years, but I'm not sure that I'm taking the right one, because I'm taking liver oils.
Okay.
I prefer to be taking a fish oil, but they all seem to come in gelatin capsules.
And you don't want the gelatin capsules.
Yeah, so I'd like somebody to tell me what's a good one.
I think we probably want to have a chat afterwards. Yeah. I never do recommendations of any one particular commercial, what have you, because, you know, I really don't think that's remotely appropriate. But I can give you some guidance. There certainly are huge differences in the quality and the composition, let alone the capsule formulations that omega-3 supplements come in. Now, with cod liver oil, I will have a word to say about that. That, of course, for quite a while, after the Second World War, up to about the 1960s, that was actually recommended to mothers, you know, small children. In fact, it wasn't primarily because of the omega-3 content, it was because of the vitamins A and D. These are fat-soluble vitamins, they are stored in the liver, so cod liver oil is a rich source of vitamins A and D. So that was the primary motivation behind the recommendation. However, the young doctor who made that recommendation, Hugh Sinclair, he was actually one of the people who pioneered research into omega-3s. Cod liver oil, because of the vitamins A and D, I wouldn't recommend anyone take in particularly high doses, because those are fat-soluble vitamins. Vitamin A in particular can be toxic in excess, so can vitamin D, although excess is less likely than it might be for vitamin A, so I would not recommend that anybody uses cod liver oil if they're wanting to take a large dose over, you know, anything on the very short experience of omega-3. Go for a fish body oil rather than a fish liver oil. I know I'm going to get the vegetarian question at some point, so I might as well deal with that one now. What do vegetarians do? We do have a pathway in the body for converting shorter chain omega-3s, which are found in some, but not many, vegetable oils, and they're usually massively outweighed by omega-6. Flax oil is usually the omega-3 source beloved of knowledgeable vegetarians. We do have a pathway for converting the short chain omega-6 into the longer chain ones, which are the ones that we need for our hearts, for our brains, for our immune systems, for really every cell in the brain and body. But that conversion pathway is not very efficient in humans. And I think, again, this audience will probably know how difficult it is to get scientists to reach a consensus. It's been described as difficult as herding cats. But the scientists, the international lipid experts, they did, in the end, reach a consensus, and they published their paper in 2009, and it's the ISFAL organisation, it's their statement, the International Society for the Study of Fatty Acids and Lipids, that the short-chain omega-3, we absolutely cannot guarantee that anyone is going to be able to make enough DHA from that, from the average figures, from all the studies that have been done in humans. There are some individuals who may be good converters, and we even now know what the genes are that control the main rate-limiting enzymes. So people will differ, they do differ genetically, in their ability to convert short-chain omega-3 into long-chain. So it is possible for vegetarians to get long-chain omega-3 from diet alone, but only if they're good converters and they don't over-consume the omega-6s. And I think I'll... would be... bad not to mention what the main source of omega-6 in our modern Western diets really is. I've mentioned meat, eggs and dairy. They will provide you with the long-chain omega-6, which are, again, essential fats. They are ones that we need. But it's the shorter-chain omega-6, which are found in all vegetable oils, and all nuts, and all seeds, and all grains. And it's the vegetable oils. It was industrialisation that allowed them to start cracking seeds and producing vegetable oils a go-go. And omega-6 from vegetable oils are now a phenomenal proportion of the fats in our diets. The shortest chain omega-6, it's called linoleic acid for anyone who's interested, it now makes up 10% of all calories in the US diet. And as Joe Hibberlin says, wow, whoever said or showed that it was safe to get 10% of all of your calories from one molecular species? Well, of course, nobody did. The food industry just found that it was cheap and convenient, and they found a way of vegetable oils much, much cheaper than butter or lard, and therefore, those are the fats that you're going to find in processed foods. And I can't not mention while I'm at it what they did to allow vegetable oils to be made into the solid or semi-solid consistency where they could substitute for butter and lard and so on. And that's a process called hydrogenation. And hydrogenation is a way that you can take liquid, cheap liquid vegetable oils and make them any consistency you like. If you fully hydrogenate a fat, you've saturated it. So you may have started with a liquid oil that was rich in polyunsaturates. I'm coming to the myth of margarine, as some of you may gather. So the liquid natural oil may be a good source of polyunsaturates, mainly omega-6. But then they hydrogenate it. So they, if it's fully hydrogenated, it's saturated. Partially hydrogenated fats can give rise to some literally toxic molecules. They're called trans fats. But wherever you see hydrogenated vegetable oils, beware. Although they aren't even going to be on some of your food labels. It took until 2009 for the World Health Organization to declare that trans fats, these twisted versions of omega-3 and 6 natural polyunsaturates, are actually toxins. In April 2010, NICE recommended to the British government ban trans fats. Denmark was the first country to be brave enough to do so. They banned trans fats as far as you can, to an absolute minimum, in 2006. We stood them. So, to come back to the vegetarians, you need to be a good converter. You need not to be awash with the short-chain omega-6 from vegetable oils, which will compete with any short-chain omega-3 you are getting, for the conversion to the longer-chain forms that the brain and body needs. But I have got some good news for those who are interested in supplements and rather than dietary things. There are now vegetarian sources of the long-chain omega-3, and they're made from algae, for the most part. So really what they've done is cut out the middleman. Fish and seafood are getting a lot of their omega-3 from the algae. But yeah, there are now. They're just not very cheap. That's the problem. And they are also, it is these vegetarian forms made from algae that are used in things like infant formula to provide the long-chain omega-3 ready-made.
Can I just ask, when you say algal stuff, you say it's vegetarian, is it also suitable for vegans?
Yes, absolutely. Sorry if anyone couldn't hear that question. Are the algal forms of long-chain omega-3 suitable for vegans as well as vegetarians? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if it comes to algae, vegetarians and vegans are both quite happy that that's a plant source. It's fine. And mind you, another source of omega-3 that's starting to come onto the market and sell is krill oil. Now, krill are tiny, tiny little shrimp-like creatures, so those would not be suitable.
You've been talking about omega-3 supplements.
Mm-hmm.
Two questions.
Yeah.
Do you take the supplements rather than take the actual fish?
It is always better to get your nutrients from food if you can. It comes
but
in a whole matrix, a whole bag. I eat as much fish and seafood as I can. And as an insurance policy, because of my own particular flipping medical history, as I say, to be told when you're relatively young that you will never be able to use your hands ever again. There's certainly, and yeah, my family history of arthritis and this and that and t'other, I take no chances here. But I do. I now like fish and seafood. It was simply that I'd never even bothered to try it. I'd just decided, as most of us do, this is what I like, this is what I don't like. But yeah.
And it's tuna.
Yeah, the oily, well, all fish will provide some of the, all fish and seafood will be a useful dietary source, and really, better than almost any other, of the long-chain omega-3 called EPA and DHA. However, the oily fish, which include salmon, tuna, mackerel, sardine, pilchards, anchovies, you know, those will have more of the long-chain omega-3 per 100 grams or whatever you want to measure it in. But all fish and seafood will make a useful contribution. So don't think that, don't like the oily fish, so, you know, I have to take supplements. No way. And there are other really important nutrients that fish and seafood provide, which, again, are often at low and suboptimal levels in many, many people's diets. Things like zinc, iodine, vitamin D, you know, etc. So, and it's also good quality protein. So fish and seafood, very, very nutritious food.
The other short point was, you were going saying about all the vegetable oils, omega 6 in the bag.
Now, olive oil, that's a nice neutral one, because most of the fats in olive oil are monounsaturated. We're talking omega 9 here, but I almost daren't mention the omega word, because I know how confusing all of this is. And I've actually been asked by very separate people, oh, I've heard that olive oil is a good source of omega 9. Is that three times more powerful than omega 3? No, where do you start? Omega 9s and omega 7s. And they're really to do with the chemistry of the molecule. At what position in the chain, numbering the carbons, you know, from a particular end, at what position is the first double bond? Olive oil is mainly monounsaturates. As I said, they're not dietary essentials, so you could make those fats for yourself if, you know, your levels fell according to your body's needs, you know, dramatically low. However, because they're not omega-3 or omega-6, this is a really good choice instead of corn oil, sunflower oil, safflower oil, all of which are pretty much 100% omega-6, zero omega-3. So if what we're trying to do is redress the imbalance that we've got in modern Western type diets, which, as I say, very, very broadly, is far too much omega-6, not enough omega-3, then to use things like olive oil, which has health benefits of its own, quite frankly, very good choice.
Is there a difference between, like, what they call olive pomace oil?
Oh dear. Now, I wouldn't want to get drawn into trying to comment on the different advertising claims and the different processing claims as to whether it's extra, super, cold-pressed, virgin, what have you. Apart from to make a general comment, it is true that the fresher and the less processed the oil, the more of the valuable nutrients will be retained, but I really can't comment on, no idea quite how many different people are trying to sell you particular types of olive oil at inflated prices. I will just say, be terribly sceptical of the whole food labelling and health claims thing. Because, yeah, if you are in a position to, and I'm sure many of this audience are, to look up that evidence and look it over with a critical eye, fair enough. But otherwise, a bit like the British Medical Journal's wonderful expose of the lack of evidence for sports drinks, which came out about a week before the Olympics, you know, this health claims business. And which products boast what is really the arena of commerce and profits again. So, yeah, I'll leave that one if I may. Yes?
So I was a bit surprised to hear you make the comment, and I know that you probably have to say this in caveat, that dietary changes alone, in particular, increase in the omega fat intake of one side, couldn't or shouldn't be used it shouldn't replace any type of
standard treatment,
right,
for psychiatric or psychological disorders.
Which,
yeah,
you know, caveat fine. But given your own experience with, mm-hmm, your ability to now not take anti-inflammatory,
indeed,
drugs, and the fact that there have been so many nutritional studies, are mostly the 80s,
mm-hmm,
about the fact that dietary changes can,
mm-hmm,
really impact schizophrenia. I was wondering what your thoughts are on the potential future for, you know, the abandonment of these pharmaceutical interventions if a proper diet.
Okay, thank you very much for raising this. For anyone who didn't hear this, it's basically picking up on the comment I made that any nutritional or dietary treatment should never be seen as an alternative to or a reason for dropping your standard treatment if you are receiving treatment for a physical or a mental health condition. And while understanding that, of course, I'm going to say that as a caveat, what do I think about, or what is the evidence that dietary approaches might be helpful in conditions like schizophrenia, for example? Now, when the American Psychiatric Association reviewed the evidence for omega-3 and psychiatric disorders, and they were doing it fairly broadly, they, and subsequent Cochrane reviews, have had to conclude that of the few trials, and it is very few trials, that have been done trying to see whether omega-3 from fish oils could help reduce the symptoms of schizophrenia,
the jury's out. Some studies found benefits, others didn't, and the meta-analysis is, quite frankly, null. However, two things I want to do here. Firstly, the American Psychiatric Association's treatment recommendations. What they did, very wisely, I think, is they took into account the general health benefits and physical health benefits of long-chain omega-3. So they did indeed include schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders in their treatment recommendations, that those patients should get at least 1 gram a day of long-chain omega-3, that's EPA and DHA, in addition to whatever other treatment they may be receiving. Because basically patients with schizophrenia, whether it's for constitutional reasons or whether it's because of their lifestyles, the treatments in some cases, they do actually have higher rates of cardiovascular disease. With the diabetes, it is true that some of the newer generation neuroleptics will themselves raise the risk of obesity diabetes, but they figured, the American Psychiatric Association, that on general health grounds, there was quite enough evidence to make the treatment recommendation extend to include those groups. But I want to be explicit, it wasn't because there was good evidence from patients with established schizophrenia that there was a significant reduction in the meta-analysis. But my next point is that, much as I said with Alzheimer's and degenerative diseases, the focus has now shifted in what research is going on into omega-3, you know, and schizophrenia, to prevention. And here, there was a study published in 2010 in the Archives of General Psychiatry, Amminger et al. It's on the Fab Research website. If anybody emails, we can point you to it. But what that randomised, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial showed was that if you gave just over a gram a day, that's 1.2 grams, of EPA and DHA to young people who had been identified as at high risk for breaking down into psychosis, if you gave them that, just over a gram a day, for just 12 weeks, and then you followed them up for 12 months, and it was a very detailed and quite frequent follow-up, so 12 weeks of treatment with the omega-3 or placebo, 12 months of follow-up, they were able to show a prevention effect that was statistically significant, and it wasn't just p-values. The most important statistic in medicine, as my friend Ben Goldacre will tell anyway, is the number needed to treat. And the number needed to treat in that study was 4. Basically, if long-chain omega-3, let's extrapolate, if this study holds up, and of course replications are needed, but 12 weeks of treatment with just over a gram a day of long-chain omega-3 could prevent breakdown into schizophrenia over a 12-month period. They didn't even keep up the supplementation for the whole period. And it could do so with a number needed to treat of 4. So you would only need to give the treatment to 4 people for one of them to be saved from becoming schizophrenic, as the diagnosis would have it. That, to me, is really, really important evidence, and the focus has been shifting to, can we prevent? Does that help answer your question? There are many other dietary approaches and so on, and other nutrients that, you know, may well play a part. And again, I want to emphasise individual differences. This is the thing. To lump together all people who fit some nebulous descriptive diagnosis like schizophrenia or dyslexia is a mistake. And it is one that plagues research, because until we pay more attention to the individual traits and features and, I would hope, underlying sort of harder objective biological measures, we're not likely to make more progress than people have made. Because to lump together so many different people with different, multiple causes we know are involved in all these conditions. But doubt is potentially one thing.
Thank you. You've made mention of the amount of nutritional information there is around.
How confusing all the information is, yeah.
So one of the questions I wanted to ask you was about the work of Patrick Holford. Because a lot of what you've spoken of I read first.
In some of Patrick's books.
And then I've read all sorts of other things. And you possibly partially answered the question by referencing your friend.
Well, when I say I don't know Ben well, we both, yeah, I did my DPhil in John Stein's lab. And it was some years after I'd done mine, but I was still doing postdoc work there, that Ben Goldacre did his own studies as a medical student with John. So that's the extent to which. And I obviously, yes, Ben's approach, you know, and his book Bad Science is probably what I need to refer anyone to and his coverage of Patrick Holford. He gave a whole chapter to that in his Bad Science publication. Does that help answer your question or not?
I haven't read that chapter.
Okay. Well, it's a bit like the chapter on Gillian McKeith.
I actually haven't read any of his book. I've just read the digest.
And Ben takes pride, I think, in the fact that neither of those two individuals can now use their respective titles of doctor and professor since the publication of his Bad Science book. Yeah, he used to do the Bad Science column in the Guardian every Saturday and developed a huge following in his website and blog, but that's right. In Gillian McKeith's case, it was the fact that I think... His own dead cat managed to get the same doctorate that had given her a doctor,
But in Patrick Holford's writing, he mentions the opening of 3 and 6 as
good,
as being good, and specifically for example, people with depression and dyslexia. And so that seems to be in accordance.
Oh, yeah, I mean, the thing is, you will find such mixtures of information all over the place, and I'm certainly, I've met Patrick on many of the conference circuits, and he's, you know, somebody who's been aware of the work that I and other people have been doing for many years. So I'm pleased if, you know, what you've picked up is that, these omega-3s might indeed have a role to play, possibly in prevention or management of a range of issues.
I could go to all this effort to follow this nutritional advice and spend a lot of time and energy, and actually it could be a problem. It takes a lot of effort to follow nutrition.
Well, this again, I think again, what we seem to have is an absolute obsession with food and with diets rather than diet. I don't know, commercial pressures here. I just want to warn, as I do in my own flipping book, if there's one thing you must do, it is, yes, keep an open mind, but as the saying goes, not so open that your brains fall out. You have got to examine yourself. Is there some real evidence behind this, or is somebody trying to sell me something? And you see, Patrick himself runs a clinic, you know, for treating, and he set up, I can't remember exactly what it was called now, but, you know, something like the Brain Bio Clinic, and this essentially was a private clinic selling treatment programmes. And I think it was that and other things that had attracted Ben's attention to, is my wound detector going off here? And he started to investigate and just found things like, you know, are the references that are being cited here in this apparently referenced book actually relevant to the point being made? And found, no, they're not. So do you see what I mean? It's so sad. And again, the same applies to media articles. Always ask yourself, because I would never have believed if our own very early work hadn't come under such media attention, quite how much almost all of our media rely on press releases that are fed to them and just cut them out. And there's your news story. So, do you know what I mean? It's a really difficult one. But you will find, you know, plenty of nuggets of good information mixed in with all kinds of, but the following of any rigorous, obsessional, including calorie counting type diets. Now, to be aware of the calorie content of foods, very useful. To be aware of portion sizes and some of the things that the better, you know, organisations or authors or people who try to help folk with weight issues or other diet things. Yes, that's useful, but don't turn it into an obsession. Food, quite frankly, I would recommend the book In Defence of Food by Michael Pollan, which is a fairly well-known, but that man has done a very, very good exposé of what he refers to as nutritionism. You know, to treat humans' food and diet as, it's a constellation of nutrients, and that again is where this whole health claim thing goes on, and also the pharmaceutical model. In fact, I myself have found it a little sad. We find it so hard to get funding for trials in this area, really hard. And the thing is, it's only when you take a pharmaceutical approach and you single out a particular nutrient and you get a patent on that for a particular use, and the patent machine, the profit machine, will allow companies who manage to achieve that, we can fund trials now, and that'll get us a health claim, and off it goes. But really, as Michael Pollan says, you know, human beings, in all the time we've been on this planet, have been eating a remarkable diversity of diets, but until industrialization, most of them were broadly not terribly highly processed, did not include a whole host of chemicals or manipulated things like trans fats, you know, that really are a product of our industrialised society and to industrialise food, and to forget that nutrition really is utterly fundamental. We really are. I mean, HarperCollins wanted a nice title for my book, so it became They Are What You Feed Them, as a mirror of You Are What You Eat. But this is true. We have to build every single cell in our bodies and brains from the nutrients that we imbibe. And then we have to keep up the supply of the essential nutrients in order to fuel and maintain and repair those cells. So what I find sad is that our health model is really built on a pharmaceutical model of disease, you know, a pill for every ill, rather than looking at a preventative approach. It is starting to change. It needs to change. We're in trouble with the approach we've got. But yeah, when it comes to diet advice or diet gurus, I think I would be suspicious of anybody who sets themselves up as a guru. And also, there is no one-size-fits-all when it comes to nutrition. We're back on the individual differences. So a diet that one person finds suits them brilliantly could actually be literally toxic to somebody else. With schizophrenia, actually, another of the issues that I will just flag, but very briefly, celiac disease. There's been an on-off, is it, isn't it, the case that perhaps wheat and gluten may be a factor for at least some individuals with schizophrenia. And because the diagnosis is so loose and it captures such a heterogeneous group of people, there never has been, and there possibly never will be, a clear answer here. But I find it interesting that you've got the same issues with the autistic spectrum, where it's only a small proportion, as far as anyone can tell, of children with autistic spectrum conditions who may benefit from a gluten-free diet, but without more research and without having reliable biomarkers of who will and won't benefit and will and won't respond to this, we're not going to know. Are we ready to wind up?
Well, I didn't know that. You know,
I could talk all night, and therefore, since you watch Hell to the Floor, it's been a matter of my reliance upon you, Annie, to leave these dear people to enjoy their evening.
Well, no, what I wanted to say, I'm sure everybody wants to ask more questions, but there is a point where we do have to stop.
Yep.
I think I'm right in saying that you would be willing to take a few private questions.
I can be around for a short while whenever my watch is gone, but I have got some visitors and guests who I'm going to have to depart before too long. But yes, absolutely.
To know more, I can't do anything but recommend this book absolutely highly. A lot of information there. Bargain price, £10, I suppose.
Oh, can I also mention, because I think it's quite an important one, if we're out here selling books while we give a talk, all author royalties go to the charity,
yes.
Food and Behaviour Research. Signed it over at the point that I wrote the book. So yeah, you will be helping the Little Fab Research charity if you might be interested in a copy of the book. And although it's broadly, by HarperCollins, aimed at children, all of the information and advice is, quite frankly, just as relevant to most adults. Thank you.
Okay, well thank you, Alex.
Yes, so I'm here with Dr. Alex Richardson after the sidebar. I've got a few additional questions to ask you, if that's okay.
Indeed.
So one of the first things I want to ask you is, how did you get involved in this research to begin with? What interested you in it in the first place?
Well, it was really quite an accidental getting into the field of nutrition. I'd started out with an interest in dyslexia that took me into research. And I'd been working for a few years and had done my own DPhil studying dyslexia and related conditions, and particularly visual and attentional difficulties in those conditions. And it was when I became aware that the long-chain omega-3 that you find in fish and seafood are critical to visual function that it struck me that, oh, this might be worth looking into as a potential treatment for some of these conditions like dyslexia, ADHD, dyspraxia or developmental coordination disorder, and a host of other conditions that involve difficulties with attention and visual perception as at least one component.
Okay, that's great. It's always nice to hear that this, I mean, do you suffer from dyslexia yourself, or?
It was through teaching, which I'd, after my own first degree, I did actually do a teacher training, and I'd been unaware of what dyslexia really meant until the kind of student that you just couldn't miss it turned up in front of me. But when I then found out what dyslexia was, I began to realise that, crikey, there's an awful lot of the students who I'd been teaching who who have these kinds of difficulties. And in fact, it's about 5 to 10% of the general population has got dyslexic difficulties of some kind or another, but the vast majority go unrecognised, unidentified. But yeah, I got very interested in that. I also realised that because of the variety, you know, dyslexia is not a single thing. None of these diagnoses, as came up during my talk and some of the questions, none of these diagnoses that they use in psychology and psychiatry are anything more than descriptions. And there's a huge variety of different forms. But basically, the role of nutrition is just not considered in any of these conditions. So once I'd made the link from vision to omega-3 to might this work as
just
a treatment...
Just had to chase it down.
Had to chase it down. I also became aware of just how important nutrition is and how totally different the diets are that we eat these days from the ones that even 50 or 100 years ago
Yeah, that was one of the compelling points that you came across there.
Indeed.
From the Victorian era.
Absolutely. No, the papers by Paul Clayton, you know, and his co-author, those are extraordinary for what they reveal.
Mm. I've got a question for that a bit later on, actually. But the other thing I was going to ask you is, what are you looking at in the lab now? Are you in the lab, or is this mostly sort of population sort of level studies that you tend to be running?
I'm no longer at a department that's got labs as such. I was at physiology in Oxford, which became physiology, anatomy and genetics. You know, I was there on and off over about a 20-year period. And also down in London, some of the labs and clinical places doing mental health research. Nowadays, for our latest school study, looking at whether long-chain omega-3 can help children's behaviour and learning, we're doing that in mainstream schools. And I've actually done a department switch that has some people taking a step back. How could you move from physiology, anatomy and genetics to the Department of Social Policy and Intervention?
I can imagine, yeah.
Well, it's just that this highlights, though, that nutrition really fits nowhere. And Oxford University doesn't even have a nutrition department. Which means that the kind of research where you put things together that cross disciplines, as mine does, makes it difficult to fit in any one place.
No, absolutely.
So I tend to do a lot of research by collaboration, but yeah, I'm at Social Policy and Intervention these days.
Okay, excellent. So one of the other questions I was going to ask you is, if we look at the diets worldwide at the moment, obviously there's going to be more developed, I'm reluctant to use that word, countries which tend to have a lot more fish in their diets.
Or is that not the case? I'm not sure you could.
Or is it as we become more Western?
How developed would we say the USA was?
Well, that's a very good question.
I thought I'd bounce that one back at you because they have one of the, oh my goodness, lowest intakes of fish and sea. Yeah, if you look at their intake of omega 3 relative to their intake of omega 6, then these are the two main forms that need to be in balance. Oh my goodness, the Americans are amongst the most omega 3 deficient nations on earth. So interestingly, South Africa and Israel are two others that people don't always expect, that they have extraordinarily high ratios of omega 6 to 3.
I was thinking more of sort of like Japan.
Now, of course, the traditional Japanese diet, that is one of the most omega 3 rich. And it's also the case that the Japanese, along with the Icelanders, whose traditional diet is, again, very rich in fish and seafood, if you look at the epidemiological, the population studies, those show unequivocally that those countries have got the lowest prevalence of conditions like cardiovascular disease, some immune disorders, but also the psychiatric disorders with which omega-3 deficiency are now being linked.
Sorry, just wait for the ambulance to go past.
For the sirens to go by. But that's right. And in fact, again, Joe Hiblum, who's based at the National Institutes of Health, he first published in The Lancet the correlational...
Something going down.
Obviously a big incident. The correlational study showing that across countries, if you simply look at average intake of fish and seafood per person per year, using economic data, and correlate that with the rates of major depression in those countries, Japan and Iceland, highest fish and seafood intake, lowest rates of depression. Somewhere like the US is at the other end, but the correlation, tight and highly significant. And he's shown that not just for depression, it was his first one in The Lancet in 1998, but he's repeated the trick for bipolar disorder, for postnatal depression, and even for suicide, and even for homicide.
So it's
and I have to say, even, well, the US military are now getting interested, because what Joe Hiblum showed last year using stored blood data from US soldiers, not only did they have about the lowest omega-3 blood levels that have ever been seen in living human beings, But it's also the case that he found that when they tracked these against completed suicides, that it was indeed the case that low omega-3 predicted risk of suicide.
Oh.
Now that was something that, as I say, he has been really leading the research in omega-3 and mood disorders and psychiatric disorders and depression, aggression and so on. But the US military, they lose more of their troops now to suicide than they do on active service, the whole issues of post-traumatic, so they are now taking this seriously.
Yeah.
And in fact, a study published just this last week, this is a much smaller one, but this was US soldiers on active duty, or US military, I can't say they were all necessarily soldiers, in Iraq. They basically found there that low blood omega-3 was associated with reduced cognitive flexibility and executive function, and particularly in the 4 out of 5 who were complaining of poor sleep quality. It was only those with good omega-3 levels or above average. I don't think any of them would have been called good by Japanese standards. They seemed to have a resistance to fatigue and performed at the top end on the range for cognitive performance. Oh,
that's very interesting. That sort of leads me on to
fish
my next
and
question.
The brain. Yeah, it's the old folk wisdom.
So, as a what I can probably characterise fairly enough as a typical Brit, I don't eat a lot of fish. So,
I didn't used
if
to.
I was to ramp that up to sort of the levels that you think would be good, or if I maybe started taking some of these supplements to add to my diet of the EPA and DHA, the longer chain omega-3s, what could I expect to happen? Do you think that I would... Is there any evidence to suggest that suddenly I'm going to start feeling a little bit better, or...?
Well, I suppose you don't know till you try, but what you could expect is that if you increase your omega-3 intake in order to get to a tissue concentration whereby about 50% of your polyunsaturates in blood, which is our easiest to measure, of course, are omega-3, which means only 50% are omega-6, that you would expect to put you into the lowest risk for things like cardiovascular disease, so heart disease and stroke, inflammatory disorders, and also, from data that's been emerging in the mental health domain, lowest risk for mood disorders and a range of other conditions that affect mental health and performance.
Okay.
You've got past childhood, and that's when they usually diagnose your dyslexia, your ADHD, your dyspraxia, or your autistic spectrum disorders, Gavin. But, you know, if any of those are still troubling you, then
I've made it this far,
there.
But it might
exactly.
Try and see, yes,
that's
yes.
Right.
So there was just one more other little question that I had in mind, which was, what do you think there's anything here that with a link with the increase in food intolerances and allergies that seems to be on the rise as well?
Okay,
or is this
very
more of an
question.
Increase in diagnosis thing that we mentioned earlier?
All right. Now, firstly, we'd better distinguish food intolerance, which is a very broad category of all kinds of mysterious things that people can't agree on objective tests, and allergy. But let's take the classic IgE, immunoglobulin E allergy. A very interesting study. There's a lot of work that's been looking at this, but since omega-3 are broadly anti-inflammatory and kind of damp down excessive immune system reactions, it's been the case that people have been very interested to see whether there might be a link between dietary omega-3 and prevalence of allergy. The biggest study of omega-3 supplementation in pregnancy that's ever been conducted to date, the so-called Domino trial, funded by the Australian government, they took 2,500 women were recruited, given either omega-3 from fish oil supplement or placebo. And one of the outcomes there, I think it was earlier this year, they published in the BMJ, the infants born to those women did indeed have lower prevalence of eczema, and also of food allergy in terms of sensitization to egg protein. They were assessing for some of the most common using IgE testing. So that was very promising. They're going to be following those children further to see whether even things like asthma, which usually develop later in so-called atopic individuals, may also be reduced. But there's mounting evidence that, yes, a lack of omega-3, and particularly in early life, this is the one we don't yet know, is how critical is it to get those omega-3 in early, and how many of problems like allergy or mental health and performance issues can be addressed by supplementation later.
Yeah.
So I always say to people, the earlier you can start, the better, but you obviously can't control what your mother ate when she was carrying you, so just don't worry about that. Just do the best you can, but do think about diet. Because nutrition really is something that we've been ignoring or just paying almost lip service to, oh, yes, yes, just eat a healthy, well-balanced diet, as though anybody knows what that is, or as though anybody does it. In fact, there's a lovely paper in the States recently that did show, even from one of the big, big long-term nurses studies there, nobody eats a healthy, well-balanced diet. And that was even in this huge cohort who've signed up to a longitudinal. No, absolutely nobody meets current dietary guidelines. And those guidelines are not yet making recommendations to get sufficient omega-3.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Alex Richardson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all for this month. Thanks for listening to our podcast. Please join us again next month when we'll be joined by neuroscientist Dr. Chris Summerfield for his talk, Believing is Seeing, How Our Minds Shape What We See. In the meantime, you can have a look at our website at www.oxfordsidebar.com for upcoming events, all of our previous podcasts, as well as our blog and news and features section, The Sidebox. You can also follow us on Twitter at Oxford Sidebar and on Facebook by searching for the British Science Association Oxfordshire branch. Once again, thanks for listening.